Good evening, I'm Leland Vittert. The empty shelves crisis has now hit the liquor aisle. Why your favorite bottle of booze might be out of stock for a while and will definitely cost more. President Biden promises to diversify the Supreme Court with a black woman. Is what the bench really lacks diversity in education? We ask that question. Why no justice went to public school for college or law school, and why that's unlikely to change. But first, up until a few hours ago, we were going to lead the show with Dr. Robert Malone. He's the man behind the Joe Rogan Spotify firestorm this week. Malone's rather out there claims on Rogan's podcast about the vaccine and COVID forced Rogan to apologize and Spotify to clarify. Here's one of the clips. Malone agreed a few days ago to join us tonight. It promised to be an important interview because he's been silenced by Twitter, the media, and thrown to the wolves by Rogan. In fact, because of Rogan's interview with him just a few minutes ago, Spotify announced Rogan, their $100 million man, will be held to a new COVID content guideline. Malone is a newsmaker. We want to be clear. He agreed to an interview, agreed on the time, and we booked a studio truck to go to his house. A few hours ago, he called our booker and canceled. He told her, I looked Leland up, and he is not the right person, not the right person I want to talk with. I guess, put another way, he didn't think this is a safe space. That's the point. His cancellation is a shame. Lots of voices have been unfairly silenced during the pandemic. His is one. It's important for us to interview him and for him to be challenged, for us to hear what he thinks. Because remember when talking about COVID coming from the Wuhan lab was a racist conspiracy theory? Facebook would delete your account for such statements against science. Well, now we know it was neither racist or a conspiracy theory, but very possibly the truth. Just think of how much we could have learned from pursuing that at the start of the pandemic rather than now. Stuff we considered conspiracy theories are now science. Things we considered science are now conspiracy theories. Remember when Dr. Fauci and the CDC said masks don't help? Remember when they said closing restaurants, shutting down travel, and ruining large parts of the American economy would save millions of lives? Those were both considered science. And if you questioned the lockdowns, you were a bleach-injecting, tin-hat-wearing nut who wanted grandma dead. Well, according to a Johns Hopkins study out today, the lockdowns made a minor difference in saving lives. From this team at Johns Hopkins, they found early phase lockdowns reduced the mortality rate by 0.2%. The study found the economic, emotional, and mental impact of lockdowns is clear. The doctors wrote they have contributed to raising unemployment, reducing schooling, causing political unrest, continuing to domestic violence, and undermining liberal democracy. Which brings us to our next point. This wasn't anybody's fault. People panicked. We all did. I still have extra protein powder from March 2020. Our executive producer still has toilet paper, so much so that it required extra space in the moving truck from California to Chicago. I'm glad I was wrong. He's glad he was wrong. But nobody in authority who made these decisions are willing to be questioned by people who might hold them to account. Nobody is willing to simply admit they were wrong. Dr. Fauci won't come on the program because back in May, I asked him about his emails and the lab leak theory. Sure, he'll go on certain networks almost every day. They won't bring up when he was wrong in the past. And he certainly won't admit he was wrong or that what he's saying now might be wrong next month. That's why it's so hard. And Malone's no better. He only wants a safe space as well. God forbid anybody question his, shall we say, unusual theories. But we want to hear them. We understand he believes that former Trump advisors Peter Navarro and Steve Bannon are a better place for his views. That's where he is right now. Think about the past week. Joe Rogan, wrong. Whoopi Goldberg, wrong. We'll get to her in a minute. Jeff Zucker, wrong. We'll get to him in a minute. The federal government, wrong. Leland Vittert, wrong. I add myself in there because you might remember this clip from Friday when I apologized to legendary broadcaster Bob Costas. So let me say it. For all to hear, I was wrong. I'm sorry, and I've learned from this. Good to see you, sir. Thank you. Mea culpa. Interestingly enough, I heard more on social media about saying I was wrong and then the kind things that Bob Costas had to say about that than any segment we have done in 6 months of the show. Evidently, saying you're wrong is rare these days, and hey, I'm still here. The American people are remarkably forgiving of those who admit they were wrong. Just ask Bill Clinton, who Arkansas threw out of the governor's mansion in 1980, only for him to apologize and win the 82 election. He did it again after the Monica Lewinsky scandal. Here he is in 1998.
I don't think there is a fancy way to say that I have sinned. It is important to me that everybody who has been hurt know that the sorrow I feel is genuine.
Went on to say that he had sinned. He left office with a 66% approval rating. We bring in a man with an approval rating far higher than 66%. Tony Katz, nice to see you, my friend. Is there a psychology that has now taken over of never saying you're wrong?
Yes, I think that's absolutely true. Very often being wrong, saying you're wrong, is seen as a sign of weakness. An apology is seen as a sign of weakness. And then there is just hearing the other side and discussing it rationally is seen as a sign of weakness. But very often we have to ask ourselves where these things come from. You know, I'm a big believer that politics is downstream of culture. But in this case, very often what we see in our politics are people calling somebody they disagree with all sorts of names instead of understanding where they're coming from. Your COVID conversation is a great one. People have been discussing for a long time that masks are hurting their kids. We're seeing speech therapists having far more patients than ever before who are kids because the speech isn't coming. And you know what they're told? They're told they want to get children killed. That's not a way to engage a conversation in a civil society. And the more we're not able to have the conversations, regardless of where you are in apologies, the less of a civil society we get.
I was just going to make that point, that it's impossible to have a civil society without a civil conversation. Interestingly enough, somebody who neither you or I really, shall we say, have a lot of warm and fuzzy feelings for is Jeff Zucker, who left today, resigned, he said, for an inappropriate relationship. As part of the investigation into Chris Cuomo's tenure at CNN, I was asked about a consensual relationship with my closest colleague, someone I've worked with for more than 20 years. I acknowledged the relationship involved in recent years. I was required to disclose it when it began. I didn't. I was wrong. Now, you can say he said that because it was part of a resignation and severance package, but he still said it.
That's where I think it gets much, much different. You admit that you're wrong when you are, not when you're caught. Those are very different things. It's hard to ask America to look at Jeff Zucker and say, you know what? He did the right thing. He did the thing that he had to do to get out with the most amount of money possible. Now, you can call that a cynical point of view, but I will bet you that 90% of Americans, 90% of the people watching this program right now, and good on them, they agree with me. When you do something wrong, you handle it. If you find $20 in the chair where you're sitting down in a restaurant, do you put it in your pocket or do you give it to the server, right? Is it only when someone notices you put it in your pocket? I should give it to the server.
No, it's what.
So
right.
It's about your own self and your own soul.
It's what you teach your kids, right? Is that you do the right thing when no one's looking, not when when people are looking. Interestingly enough, it was Allison Camerota who defended Zucker. Take a listen.
These are two consenting adults who are both executives. Mm-hmm. That they can't have a private relationship feels wrong.
Well, I think there's.
Well, let us break it down to its two component parts. First of all, I want to say how much I agree with Allison here. Mm-hmm. They're two consenting adults who can do anything they want. I never knew about their bedroom habits. I don't care about their bedroom habits. The issue here is you have rules, and let's find out all the other people at CNN or MSNBC or News Nation or Fox or anywhere else who got fired for breaking those rules. As a matter of fact, there are people on that network who lectured to people like myself about how we're bad people if we didn't condemn these kinds of actions. So in that situation, Allison looks the fool because she is not taking into account the fact that she's part of the lecturing class, but now that it's her friend or pal or buddy or former boss, however she may see it, she doesn't want to engage a, hey, you did it wrong. And if he did it wrong, when he's admitting it now, that's not enough. He should have figured it out 3 days after he knew he was wrong, 3 weeks, 3 months, 3 years.
Yeah,
he had plenty of time.
Yeah, I wasn't going to say fool. I was going to say hypocrite. But almost like being wrong, being a hypocrite, if we bring this full circle, is no longer seen as something to be shameful of. In the same way that admit, you know, if you're a if you admit you're a hypocrite, you're seen as weak. And if you admit you're wrong, you're seen as weak. If you apologize, you're seen as weak.
So you're bringing up the idea that we have a society that just wants to get the slam, right? We want to get the good thing on Twitter. We want to get the good dig in these kinds of conversations here on cable news, et cetera. But you also have to understand that there are a lot of people out there who have been the victims of these attacks for years. And politically, the political right feels this way. It's been a constant, continual deluge and attack year after year. And they are just, they've had enough and they are fighting back. And you might not think it's pretty, but you got to at least understand where they're coming from.
Look, you've been very, very good on this. It's why we want to have you on, because people don't necessarily always give you the credit you deserve for sort of your understanding of American culture. You were on the Trump train and talking about how Trump was saying things that middle America was feeling. And that's why he was popular all the way back in 2015. It was an incredibly perceptive view. You bring up politics, and we'll end it here, but I want to get your thoughts. Because the idea of politicians now just running to their safe spaces goes on both sides. This isn't a Democrat or a Republican thing. Joe Biden almost exclusively talks to George Stephanopoulos. The president of the United States only being interviewed by effectively one person is troubling. On the other hand, Donald Trump, former President Trump, will only speak to OAN or Newsmax. This seems to be a problem.
Well, first, you have where your natural bases are, and they accept that.
I understand speaking to your base, but how much of it is they don't want to be questioned? They don't want to have to admit they were wrong or be shown to be
wrong. It's funny. Those are two different things. Not willing to be questioned, I would say of President Trump, that guy will take any question you throw at him. He may just disagree with you on the question.
Back in the day, fair enough.
Admitting the wrong is a very, very different conversation. It is extremely hard for people. And sometimes they're being told to admit they're wrong when they don't actually believe they're wrong. I would rather they didn't apologize in some kind of falseness, right, and pretend to that it matters. Yeah. It's like Whoopi Goldberg. Is she really sorry? I have no reason to think otherwise, but I don't 100% know. And we don't 100% know because we don't give people credit for the apology anymore at all.
You know what? Stick around, because we have a reason perhaps to believe that she's not really that sorry. We'll show it to you a little later in the show. Tony, thanks for interrupting the vacation. It's good to see you.
Always, man.
Yeah, always can count on you. Thank you. Back to lockdowns. As we mentioned, the verdict is in. They made a minor difference in saving lives. Bringing a friend of the show, Dr. Amish Adalja, who studies infectious disease at Johns Hopkins. The study, Doc, came from Hopkins. What do you make of it, and how conclusive is it?
I think it kind of backs up what many of us have thought for some time, that these blunt tools like lockdowns, because of the way they were instituted and because of what they included, what they didn't include, because of people's compliance, because of people doing things that were kind of more risky but underground, for example, gathering indoors at someone's house and eating outdoors, we're not going to be that effective, that these blunt tools just aren't what we want to be reaching for. And if you are reaching for them, that tells you that many policies have failed before you even get to such a blanket type of order.
Yeah, stay-at-home order only saved 2.9% of lives, school closure 4.4%. I mean, we were told that this was going to save millions upon millions of people. Do you think that the powers that be have learned from this?
It's unclear, because what we see, for example, in places like Europe is that they run back to lockdowns. Or when we heard about the Omicron variant, travel bans got put in place universally, even though we knew they wouldn't work. I think politicians want a quick and easy solution, and that's what they're going to reach for. But what we need to really instill in people is that it should be targeted, precision-guided, voluntary guidance to people so that they can learn how to navigate risks, to know what's more risky, what's less risky. Because, for example, if you're telling people they can't go to a park, it makes no sense based on transmission. And at the same time, you're not actually taking the effort you need to do to stop mortality by, for example, fortifying nursing homes. Instead, many governors did the opposite with nursing homes.
Yeah, you're specifically New York and Andrew Cuomo. I wanted you to help put in perspective the study in these statistics. States with strict lockdowns versus states with loose lockdowns. This is total deaths per 100,000 people. New York, 0.88, Michigan, 1.03, Florida, 0.84, South Carolina, 0.71. In both of those cases, COVID deaths per 100,000 over the entire time, the non-lockdown states did far better. Is that what we're seeing in this data?
I do think that states that were less stringent with their lockdown policies did a lot better than most people predicted. And I think we have to go back and examine why that is. Is it because those tended to be warmer states or more things could be done outdoors? Or is it because people voluntarily did what the lockdowns couldn't achieve? If you look at cell phone mobility data, you can see when COVID was bad in a certain area, people voluntarily, ahead of any governor's order, started to decrease their movements and limit their circles of interaction. So some of the data on decreasing mortality might actually be from people's voluntary actions rather than a governor saying, this is what you must do. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done to actually analyze where states fell on that map. But clearly Florida and Texas, for example, did a lot better than other states. And I think that's something that needs to be explained.
Yeah, I want to get back, and I don't know if you were able to hear all of the open, and if so, we appreciate you being here early for the live shot, especially with kids in the background. I'm wondering about if we're going to hear from any of the scientists, the government folks who did these lockdowns, that they were wrong, or maybe they didn't work, and be willing to go back and do the postmortem. And if so, great. If not, how dangerous is it for science if you don't learn from your mistakes?
I think it is important for people to go back and look at the decision-making and what drove those decisions. And we already know that the WHO has said that lockdowns are evidence of a policy failure. But what I think happened is, in places like New York City, where they were really worried about the hospitals being able to survive, they had to do something in order to kind of pull a circuit breaker so that those hospitals didn't get crushed. But what happened is many governors across the country just extrapolated what was going on in New York City and then had an indefinite type of lockdown, which wasn't driven by metrics, and it didn't necessarily work, and it didn't actually do the things they needed to do, which was work on nursing homes, get testing stood up, get people the ability to understand which activities are more risky and less risky. All of that is something that I think we have to go back and revisit. And many of the policymakers were kind of going off of infectious disease experts telling them what will decrease cases. And it's up to those policymakers to be able to weigh all of that and say, what are the long-term consequences of this? Is this sustainable? What are the negative cascading impacts we're going to see with schooling, with other medical care, with people's mental health and substance abuse? And that's something where all of our governors basically abdicated. They didn't know what to do. They didn't think long-term. They just panicked. And I think that's what we have to really get over, because there's going to be another infectious disease emergency. And we have to get our policymakers up to speed to take this seriously and take the correct action, not just take any action.
You have, from the very beginning of this, been a sober and serious voice, and to your credit, have said things earlier and said I was wrong then and come back. And that's why we keep having you back, and we're glad you come. Thank you, Doc. Good to see you.
Thanks.
Yeah. Coming up, why it might be harder than you think to find your favorite bottle of booze, and if you do, it's going to be more expensive. Plus, a Canadian anti-vaccine mandate protest spreads thousands of miles. We'll talk to one of the truckers about what this means for the United States. Welcome back. Anti-COVID vaccine mandate protesters, you can see them here, are blocking a major highway that connects Canada and Montana. Might not sound like a big deal, but a group of truckers organized the protest that started over the weekend in Ottawa. That's the capital. These are images now from the border crossing. Sees up to 1,200 trucks each day, every day. It's the only 24/7 checkpoint between Alberta and Montana. It's a crucial artery for trade between the United States and Canada, our most important trading partner. And keep in mind, this checkpoint's 2,000 miles away from where the protest first started. It's not just truckers who are involved. Now there are hundreds of Canadians who have caravaned with the group to this checkpoint. They may head to other checkpoints. We bring in Adam Sturr, who's parked his truck outside Parliament in Ottawa and says he is not moving. All right, Adam, you're not moving. Is there any sense that the Canadian government is going to budge on this vaccine mandate?
Well, we have seen the Quebec government drop a proposed tax on unvaccinated people, and they claim it's got nothing to do with the pressure that's being applied here. But, you know, they can say what they would like, but there is a lot of pressure being applied here, and I definitely think they're feeling it.
Well, no kidding. We have some of the pictures, hopefully, of where you guys are in Ottawa. This is from the border itself, so much so that the prime minister at one point went to a secure location. This is the video from Ottawa. It's stunning how many people showed up. And this is what the Prime Minister had to say. Take a listen.
The small fringe minority of people who are on their way to Ottawa or who are holding unacceptable views that they're expressing do not represent the views of Canadians. We won't give in to those who fly racist flags.
You guys don't like vaccine mandates. Is there anything about this that has to do with race?
No. No, there's nothing. I've been down here. I got down here on Friday. I rolled in with two of my best friends in the world. They're both people of color. And I mean, we were looking for racists down here. And I mean, there is nothing going on down here. Like, the mainstream Canadian media is doing an extreme disservice to the public by lying like they are about what's actually happening here.
This for you guys, is this about the vaccine or vaccine mandates? 85% among the Canadian Trucking Alliance are vaccinated, 50 to 60% among the American Trucking Alliance. So what are you guys upset about exactly?
Well, that's a good question, Leland. Myself, I am vaccinated. This is about the mandates. No one here is anti-vax. I mean, there are anti-vaccine people here. But I mean, that's not the purpose of the protest. The purpose of the protest is to give people freedom of choice, freedom of bodily autonomy. People should be able to decide what medical procedures they undergo without fear of having to be ejected from society. Like, and to call this number of people a fringe minority that hold unacceptable views, like, I'm sorry, but what view is unacceptable that I should be able to control my own body?
Well, one thing that might be unacceptable is wearing blackface, which is something that Justin Trudeau has done in the past. But
more than once.
Yeah, there you go. And we have the pictures. So he knows a few things about unacceptable views. But there's a larger point here, though, in terms of where this is headed. You've got one border crossing shut down. That can last for a little while, but this goes on. You're talking about shutting down big parts of the U.S. economy, the Canadian economy. There's threats of police action against you. You willing to go to jail for this?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. They're going to have to drag me out of here because this matters. If we let this go, where does it stop? What are they going to do next? Like, at some point, enough is enough. And I believe we've reached that point. And most reasonable people who are joining me here feel the same way.
Hey, I admire you being willing to talk about it. And clearly, Adam, you and your friends are putting your money where your mouth is. If your wheels aren't rolling, you're not making any money and you're sitting outside Parliament protesting. So it'd be worthy of the media paying attention and at least being willing to give you your due. Thanks for talking to us.
Thank you, Leland, for telling the truth about what's going on here.
Just let you talk. We appreciate it. Thank you. All right. All of us who drank our way through the pandemic. I have some bad news. We have emptied our own bottles, literally. The same way we panic bought toilet paper, we all panic bought our favorite alcohol, or we just consumed more of it. And now the world's largest spirit makers, Diageo, is running low on its most popular products. The pandemic had increased the demand for Crown Royal Whiskey, Lagavulin Scotch, Bullet Bourbon, and Don Julio Tequila. Of course, the supply chain crisis has contributed to the problem, causing backups in delivery. But the main issue seems to be the reserves that have already been drained. The pandemic started, we all bought more alcohol. Suppliers dipped into their reserves, we all bought through the reserves. And now suppliers have no reserves, and we have no alcohol. Basically, we have an empty barrel crisis. And for those of you who participated in Dry January, it might have been easier than most years. And for the rest of us, we may be having a sober spring out of necessity, also because the cost of the alcohol you can find has gone way up. Joining us now, Reservoir Distillery Company, Dave Cutino. Dave, it's good to see you. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Good to see you, Leland.
All right. So what's the deal here? Can't you just make more of this stuff?
Well, I do think that the amount of whiskey that has been made in the last couple of years has increased dramatically year over year. I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but it's moving up by 10-15% every year. It's not so much that we have a lack of actual juice to get to people. It's more a matter of bottles than anything else. There are a couple of mistakes that were made early on in the pandemic where some projections on what would happen when restaurants shut down, that there'd be less demand for glass. So some of the glass manufacturers shifted production into other products. And now as a result, we don't have enough bottles to fill up and get to people.
How much of this has to do with aging? And I think about this, barrel to bottle, Scotch 16 years, Bullet Bourbon 10 years, Crown Royal 3 years, Don Julio tequila 2.5 years. I know you guys do some age stuff. At some point, you can't speed up the aging process with the higher demand. I'm guessing you just got to raise prices.
That's exactly right. And that's something that we've been seeing over the last couple of years. And certainly prices are definitely going up right now. We have a lot of inflationary pressures throughout the system of our own supply chain. But to your point on aging, you can't rush it. And so, you know, as demand goes up and chews through what we have available, you can't just suddenly replace it with the exact same aged whiskey. You might have to go a little bit younger in age. And you definitely see that with a lot of bottle labels have shifted into not having age statements anymore.
Yeah. Well, see, this is why we have you on. So now we know what to look for at the liquor store. One group figured out how to deal with this. Headline from the New York Times, that $1,000 bourbon you bought may be phony. Counterfeiting, filling luxury bottles with cheap liquor has hit American whiskey hard as sky-high prices raise the payoff for scammers. Is this a real deal?
Yeah, that's a very real thing.
Is it just $1,000 bottles, or are we talking about $100 bottles too?
I don't think that anybody's messing around with $100 bottles. There's plenty of real bottles that have gone up in price to $100 or more that are available. You see that all the time. But certainly anything that's over $1,000, you have to question if it's real or not.
So I guess this is good for the cannabis industry, perhaps. What happens?
A lot easier to grow.
Well, there is that. Good point. Touché. Where's this go from here?
Well, certainly, I think that in the next year, some of the problems that we do have with empty shelves is because of labor shortages and just getting product that is available to the actual retail store. And I think that'll alleviate in the next few months as the pandemic kind of works to try to come to a close. Now, the bottle shortage is something that I wish I had a crystal ball and I could tell you how long that's going to take. If I did, I'd be a bottle manufacturer, but I don't see it letting up anytime soon.
Wow. Well, I guess that means we'll have to have you back. Thanks. Good luck getting more bottles. You got some behind you. Thanks for the insights, all right?
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you. Good to see you. A frontrunner emerges in the Supreme Court search. Tell you who she is and why diversity might come from actually a different candidate who resembles the country. We'll be back in a minute. Here's President Biden has a clear frontrunner for the open Supreme Court seat. We could see the famed interview between Ketanji Brown Jackson and the president within the next week or two. That would happen at the White House. Stand by for that. News Nation's Kelly Meyer live at the Capitol, where already the Republicans are plotting their strategy for confirmation, as are the Democrats. Good evening, Kelly.
Good evening, Leland. Well, she is quickly becoming the favorite here on Capitol Hill, and she's someone that has already been through the Senate process. Just last year, the Senate confirmed her as Biden's choice for the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. And that's often a stepping stone to the nation's highest court. She had the support of Republicans like Senator Chuck Grassley, who is a main player on the committee that would confirm her this time around.
All right, so you mentioned Grassley, who people have been trying to interview. Republicans have been all over the map on this. Leadership has a very different view than Lindsey Graham, which has a very different view than the presidential contenders.
Well, Leland, right now they just don't have a strategy. We saw Republican Senator Lindsey Graham in a rare meeting with his South Carolina colleagues, Republican Senator Tim Scott and Democratic Majority Whip Jim Clyburn. We can only guess they were talking about their support for the South Carolina candidate, Judge Michelle Childs. Graham is a usual critic of the Biden administration, but he's now agreeing with the president's promise to nominate a black woman to the Supreme Court, saying, quote, it's about time. Another Republican, Mississippi's Roger Wicker, saying Biden's vow to consider only black women is, quote, quote, affirmative action. GOP leaders, as you mentioned here, they're urging members to keep the focus on issues like inflation and the border, not the Supreme Court battle here. Leland?
You have to wonder what really is going to matter in the midterms for Republicans, whether it's a SCOTUS battle or the kitchen table issues. Kelly, thank you very much. Good to see you as always. The president has more than one chance to make history with this nomination. Here's the tweet. Over the last 50 years, 18 justices have been sworn into the Supreme Court, from Harry Blackburn in 1970 to Amy Coney Barrett in 2020, and none, not a single one, attended a public or state institution of higher education. Not for undergrad, not for law school. The current bench is made up almost exclusively of Harvard and Yale grads. Amy Coney Barrett went to Notre Dame, which is a private school. President Biden's shortlist of candidates does include a woman who got her law degree at a public university. But whether or not he picks her seems to be, well, up in the air. Certainly she is not the front runner. With that, we bring in Fulbright scholar and Tennessee law professor Ben Barton. All right, Ben. You teach at a public school, so I feel like you've got a little bit of a dog in this fight here. Is there something that the Supreme Court should just be the best and brightest there for those who are educated at Harvard and Yale?
We need diversity that's not just race and gender. I mean, that's important, but we also need diversity of education and experience. There has always been a Harvard grad on the Supreme Court, from the first one with John Jay all the way to today. But there's no reason why everybody on the Supreme Court should have gone to Harvard or Yale. That's just not a good way to run a business or a court.
So if you think about the notable nominees, these are sort of three from the short list. Ketanji Brown Jackson, Harvard, California Supreme Court Justice Leandra Kruger, Yale, and U.S. District Judge Michelle Childs, University of South Carolina. That's who Tim Scott, Lindsey Graham, and then also Jim Clyburn, all from South Carolina, have been talking about. Does the difference in where you go to school make all that much of a difference in your legal education?
Yeah, so just think about it this way. Most of these folks went to undergrad in an Ivy League school and then on to law school in an Ivy League school. Basically, they were trying to get on the Supreme Court when they were 14. Like, people who failed ninth grade algebra need not apply, and that is just way too soon for this sorting mechanism. We want demonstrated merit across a whole career, not just in undergrad and in law school. And you can be like J. Michelle Childs and go to University of South Carolina and then have a spectacular, amazing legal career that qualifies you to be on the Supreme Court. We should not check people basically when in their late teen years or in their early 20s.
So why does Harvard and Yale have this exclusive hold on the court?
Part of it is just how hard it is, these confirmation battles. Presidents, and this is a bipartisan thing, the Obama nominees look really similar to the Trump nominees, frankly. I mean, Merrick Garland is basically an identical career to Kavanaugh and Gorsuch. But basically, because it's hard to get these nominees through, they want to take qualifications off the list. They just want to make that an easy part of it. So they just go ahead and choose justices that look like the current justices and figure that'll help them slide through. That being said, I don't know if you paid attention to Kavanaugh. It's not like his going to Yale and Yale really helped that much, let alone Garland, right?
Yeah, no, both of those were unusual circumstances. You make a good point. And look, Amy Coney Barrett also had a very tough confirmation hearings for different reasons. Socioeconomic breakdown of who gets into Ivy League, and this can be used as a little bit of a proxy, also sort of for who you are around during your most formative years, not necessarily who you are. Socioeconomic breakdown of who gets into Ivy League schools, 14.5% from the top 1% of America, only 3.8% from the bottom 20%. So the top 80% of America represents, 96% of the school. It's very rare that you're going to be around people who have these different socioeconomic experiences.
No, for sure. And then the other thing is that, then you graduate, these folks graduate law school. Five of them went on and clerked on the Supreme Court. They've just had the most elite experiences every step of the way. And again, none of these experiences bring you in contact with regular people. Believe me, if you go to University of South Florida and then you go to University of South Carolina for law school, you meet a lot of regular folks. Like, that's just kind of how it goes. Some of these folks, I mean, it's really funny. Alito and Sotomayor both went to Princeton and then on to the same law school. They've had almost the exact same experience since they were 18 forward, which is just bizarre given that they're different folks on the court, but their life experiences are really, really similar.
Yeah, especially you also think that for Democrats who believe that the Constitution is evolving, and it's so much about the context of the time we're living in, that life, those different life experiences would be all the more important. Professor, we really enjoyed this conversation. Thank you for taking the time. It was a great piece in the Wall Street Journal, written by a man who went from to the University of Michigan and then teaches at the University of Tennessee.
Very nice. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. Strategic or criminal, what should we consider possibly throwing NFL games? Miami Dolphins coach Brian Flores is suing the NFL and a handful of teams over racial discrimination. He wants it to be a class action lawsuit. He also accused his old boss, the Miami Dolphins owner, Stephen Ross, of asking him to lose games intentionally and allegedly offering him money to do it.
Did Ross, to you, explicitly say to you personally, I'll give you $100,000 each game you
lose? Yes. Yes, he did. Absolutely. It's not something you make up.
It's also something he doesn't have any proof for. The idea of tanking intentionally, losing games, has long been a part of professional sports, especially in recent years. Lose extra games, get a better draft pick, and the team's better off in the long run. That's how the argument goes. But the allegations are serious and go to the heart of the integrity of the game and even have potentially criminal implications. We welcome Liz Clark, sports writer for The Washington Post. Hey, Liz, we talked about Flores' accusations yesterday as it relates to race. In the sports world, in the NFL world, what's sort of causing bigger issues, the idea of tanking games or the idea that the NFL is racist?
Oh, boy, that's a good question. I mean, this lawsuit definitely is in the two buckets you mentioned, the systemic accusation of, you know, racist hiring practice and an allegation that he was offered money to tank games. I'd say, you know, there's a group of people that have suspected racist hiring practices for 20 years at least. So in some ways, maybe that was not a shock. But I think the allegation specific to an NFL owner about offering money to tank games, that was shocking. That is seismic. It's something fans joke about or talk about, like, gee, right. I wish my team would just lose out and we'd get this guy. It's a great bar conversation, but it is unthinkable in the NFL. It strikes, as you said, I believe, to the heart of the integrity of the game.
Yeah, you think also, and these are some of the, you know, Trevor Lawrence responds to, you know, all tank for Trevor, all, you know, tank for Tua. Alabama QB weighs in on NFL fans wanting their team to lose so they get to pick him. But this also goes to, you know, this goes to the integrity of betting. This goes to young players who may or may not make the next roster based on whether or not their team wins or loses. Hugh Jackson suggested he was also paid to throw games during his time with the Cleveland Browns. Winless season in 2017, 16 losses. Jackson said on Twitter the Browns owner Jimmy Haslam was happy with the team losing. When questioned, he didn't make $100,000 a loss like Brian Flores did. He said it was a good number. That's the first corroboration we have, but we got to point out the lawyer here, Doug Wigdor, who's made some awfully outlandish accusations in the past, and his client presented absolutely zero evidence, zero, that there's been any game rigging.
Well, we'll see if this does go to trial, what evidence comes forward. But just to restate, and you hinted at really the key ones, and it shouldn't really need to be said, why would tanking games, tanking a season, not be a good thing in pro sports and pro football in particular? This comes at a moment when the NFL has done a complete 180 on legalized gambling. They are embracing it. They put a team in Las Vegas. It is a big part of their future revenue. You cannot go hard in embracing partnerships with gaming entities when your own executives are tanking games, or there's that question.
Yeah, no, it goes.
And as you said,
yeah, no, it's all the marbles there. And you think about the possibility of criminal charges and the like. Hey, unfortunately, we got to run, Liz. But thank you very much. Obviously, a lot more here as this goes on. We'll talk to you soon.
There is.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
All right. If proven, should NFL owners and coaches be criminally charged if they throw games? Up next, what we've learned about Whoopi Goldberg that she has not. We end where we started, admitting you're wrong. Let's remember how the week started for now suspended host of The View, Whoopi Goldberg.
Then let's be truthful about it, because the Holocaust isn't about race.
No.
It's not about race.
And then somehow she made it worse by going on Colbert to clarify with this doozy.
Most of the Nazis were white people, and most of the people they were attacking were white people. So to me, I'm thinking, how can you say it's about race if you are fighting each other? I said, this wasn't racial. This was about white on white. And everybody said, no, it was racial. And so that's what this all came from.
So just to be clear, she made it as though the Jews really had a chance against the Nazis. So now we're talking about a woman who said the Holocaust wasn't about race and then made that situation worse. It's a unique skill. Today, she doubled down, tripled down, quadrupled down, whatever you want to say, leaking that she might quit The View. Remember, in her words, it's our fault for misunderstanding. So she's the victim. As if to emphasize the point, here's a picture of her today, wearing a jacket out that said innocence. Hard to imagine the choice in clothing is a coincidence. After all, she believes she's innocent, that she's upset at us for misunderstanding. Considering the other side, she was really sorry. How about taking a 2-week suspension that she has and heading to Israel, to the Holocaust Museum there, Yad Vashem, then to Poland to visit the camps at Auschwitz and Birkenau and Treblinka. So now we end the show where we started. I was wrong about Whoopi. For the past 2 days, I've worked under the assumption that she was just ignorant and thus maybe just a little bit sorry. It appears I was wrong, proving the late, great Maya Angelou correct once again. When people show you who they are, believe them the first time. Dan Abrams is next. He has a slightly different take on Whoopi. Let us know what you think on social media, at Leland Vittert, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We'll see you tomorrow night.